So, what are some of the broad assumptions of evolutionary psychology theory, the theoretical underpinnings of it? Well, first off, psychologists, so dealing with brain stuff here, like other areas of psychology, we assume that the brain is actually a physical system. We've been long recognized that evolution operates on physical systems. Well, the brain is a physical chunk of stuff. The way that our thoughts work are predicated upon the underlying physical architecture of our brains. Ergo, if evolution can act on, select for, modify, and change physical systems, then our behavior patterns, which are ultimately due to the underlying physical architecture of the brain, can also be evolutionarily selected for, evolutionarily modified. So, second point that comes out of this then, and we'll talk about some of the sort of particulars of this in a little bit, but let's just say for now, the idea is that the current psychological systems that we have, be they neurological, cognitive, behavioral, whatever, were adaptively selected for back in the past due to problems that our ancestors would have encountered. Okay? And this period under which this evolutionary selection operated on us, we call the environment of evolutionary adaptiveness. So we'll talk about this in a little bit more detail, but the idea here is that our ancestors faced certain environmental, social, cultural difficulties, and selective pressure then would have been applied. Adaptation would occur with respect to certain behaviors. So many of the either neuronal or behavioral architectures that we have now would have been selected for in the past. And we just very broadly call this period of the past under which this selection occurs the environment of evolutionary adaptiveness. Now, very broadly here, one of the assumptions of many, but not all, evolutionary psychologists is that these selective pressures have produced what are called cognitive modules or cognitive modularity. That is, we've got, if you will, specific parts of the brain that had been evolved to do very particular things. So we'll come back and talk about this in a lot more detail later on in the course, but just keep that in mind, that there are, you know, ever had that sort of, boop, made you look, sort of response? Arguably that's some sort of a cognitive or neurological module that forces your attention on to something. All right. So, as I said, brain is a physical system here. As a physical organ, then, when you take the brain out and look at it, I got brains in my office. Want to come by and see some brains? Come on by my office. All kinds of brains there. Human, non-human, all right. So, physical organ there. For lack of a better word, we'll just call the activity of the brain the mind. As I said, evolution typically studies the physical side of things here. Well, our behaviors, our mind comes out of the physical form, so we can apply evolutionary theory to this. We can study the behavior in an evolutionary context. This is perfectly valid to do. As the environment of evolutionary adaptiveness. We abbreviated the EEA because otherwise it's kind of a large mouthful to have to keep going through every time you want to say it. So the EEA. Now, there is some debate about exactly what years the EEA dealt with. Generally, and this is a little bit of a traditional view on this, but the sort of traditional evolutionary psychology view is that the EEA went from a long time ago, hundreds of thousands, maybe a couple million years ago, up to about 8 to 10,000 years ago. Sort of once we sort of start moving out of our hunter-gatherer pattern of existence and start settling down as agrarians. There's some very interesting recent issues that call some of this sort of 10,000-year-ago cutoff point into question, but we'll talk about those later. But the idea here is that through this period of a few hundred thousand, maybe a million years ago, up to relatively recently, there's a lot of various selective pressures that would have shaped species-specific traits. Now, part of the reason why many evolutionary psychologists like to sort of go from a few hundred thousand years ago up to maybe about 10,000 years ago is because humans' ability to radically modify the environment was somewhat limited during this period. Oh, sure, you could chop down some trees, and yes, you could, you know, you could end up setting a forest fire and whatnot, but, I mean, wasn't a huge amount of modification that could be done, right? We weren't building dikes and flooding out huge sections of coastal regions. We weren't plowing under large swaths of forest to do planting and whatnot. We didn't have herds of 10,000 animals moving across the plains and eating it down to the dirt, leading into erosion issues. So if we go to this, so consequently, the idea here is that through this time period, the environment would have been relatively, at least the physical environment, would have been relatively consistent. Oh, sure, I mean, ice ages come and go, but that happens slowly. There's time for humans to adapt to that. But in terms of over the last, you know, 8 to 10,000 years ago, we've been changing our environment very, very rapidly, at an increasingly rapid pace, right? I mean, you just have to look at the stuff happening with climate change and from the industrialized products to see how rapidly we can actually change our environment. Now, we've got some real problems with this. So, the idea here then is that over this fairly environmentally consistent period of time, this is when many of these selective pressures would have been placed on humans, and they would have been fairly consistent, and therefore this would have given evolution lots of opportunity to select for particular behavioral characteristics. Okay? Now, one of the consequences of this is some of the things that were adaptive in the past may not be particularly adaptive in the present. Our environment has changed markedly. Classic example of this are the so-called, you know, obesity epidemic sweeping through North America and other parts of the world. In the EEA, very, very difficult to get access to fats and sugars, high caloric foods. Those of our ancestors who would, hey, here's a bunch of honey and, you know, a fatty wildebeest that I can eat. And went, oh, no, you know, that's, I'm trying to cut down because that's just going to go straight to my stomach and my hips. And, oh, it's, no, thanks, thanks, but no thanks, right? They starved to death during the drought season. Those were ancestors who said, hoorah, yeah, having a feast. They probably made it. But again, that kind of access to fatty, high caloric foods was pretty limited. Nowadays, one, two, three, four. See, at least four people, including myself, that wandered over. Tim Hortons, you know, got our Timmies there. And, I don't know how many people put cream in their coffee, but, you know, I mean, you know, you go to Timmy's, you know, maybe you get the donut, maybe you don't. It's just like, it's pretty accessible, okay? Fatty foods, high caloric foods. We have no problems, as my pear-shaped body demonstrates, we have no problems getting access to high caloric foods. So our ancestral predispositions, perhaps, to, if they're available, consume them. Well, in the past, they weren't that available. Now they're readily available. Now the problem is how not to consume. Okay? So we've got a little bit of a conflict here. And we'll talk about other aspects of this as we go through the course. All right. So I mentioned modularity. Now, the original concept of modularity goes back to a book by a guy called Fodor from 1983. Fodor was really more of a philosopher who was interested in the neurosciences. And in 83, he wrote what he called The Modularity of Mind. Again, not really a psychologist, more of a philosopher. So mind is a bit of an unfortunate term here, but it has a nice alliteration to it. And being philosophical, I think philosophers think more about mind as opposed to, you know, the modularity of brain doesn't roll as trippingly off the tongue. Anyways, what Fodor said here was having looked at, read a lot of neuroscience. I mean, for somebody not specifically trained in the neurosciences, he's no slouch at understanding this. He said, look, it seems that the way that our brain works, or at least certain parts of it, specifically those parts that are involved in the perceptual system, is they have very small connected neural systems that are independent. In fact, what he called impenetrable. So think of it this way. You've got some neural architecture that handles, like, have you ever sat someplace and something flickers on the edge of your vision and makes you look? You know, bar or something, or doctor's office, TV's up in the corner, turned off, you know, something moves suddenly, makes you look, or even just sitting at home, right? You know, maybe you got the volume down on the TV and show or a commercial changes, so it goes from a dark screen onto a light screen. You look up, look back down. Okay, so it's called flicker fusion effect, or flicker effect. That's something that's, you almost can't not look. You kind of got to, you can't, right? But it's a reflexive system. Okay, you can, it's like, oh, no, I'm absolutely not going to look at it. But so you're cognitively overriding your reflexive system. But there's a little system in there that makes you, and I mean, if you think about this from an evolutionary perspective, this makes a certain amount of sense. If something suddenly moves on the edge of your peripheral vision, either it's perhaps something that's running towards you to eat you, so you should, like, bugger off, or you're going to be dead. Or it's something that's running away because it's worried that you're going to eat it, in which case you should chase it and try to eat it, because going back to the caloric, fatty... Okay, so those of our ancestors that didn't respond to this probably pretty quickly got eaten. So, small, but I mean, you can't use that to do anything else. I mean, you can't use that little chunk of neural architecture to, you know, do your email or listen to music or something. It's dedicated. Okay. Think about this. You got like a calculator, okay, like a dedicated little calculator. Boom. You hit on, it's on. Okay. As fast as you can punch the keys, you're doing math. All right. Most people's computers, notebooks or desktops, have some calculator in there as well. But you got to load the program. It takes a little bit longer to load that. It's a little slower. Your computer is a very general purpose thing. Once you actually finally get that little calculator program loaded up, it's going to be pretty quick. Okay, unless you got a whole bunch of other processing going at the computer, in which case you're going to slow everything down. Not usually a case for modern computers because their processors are just so darn fast, but I'm old enough to remember when computers were much, much slower and couldn't do more than about three things at once, all right? And if you were doing all three of them, everything was going to be slow, okay? So this is the thing. If you've got a dedicated set, but your calculator, your dedicated little calculator, it's always the same speed. It's always fast. It doesn't have to share computational power with anything else. That little flicker fusion system that makes you, that orients you towards something that moves, it's quick. It's impenetrable. It can't do anything else, but it's damn fast at what it does. And it works very consistently. Okay? So from an evolutionary perspective, that's potentially really useful. Now, Fodor's talking about these little perceptual systems. In the 90s, early 90s, the early sort of founders of modern evolutionary psychology take this and run with it and say, yeah, sure, definitely, that makes sense. Evolution would select for these systems. They say, but we think evolution has also done essentially the same thing with cognitive systems. So not just the perceptual systems, but the cognitive ones as well, and the behavioral ones. So we'll talk, for example, later on in the course about things like, for example, a social cheat detection system. So is there a social cheat detection module? We live in social groups. It would make sense that we should have evolved some module that is dedicated towards trying to see if someone is cheating us in a social situation. Okay, now there's a debate as to whether or not it actually works that way, but there's the idea of modularity. I said, we're going to come back to it a lot more. So this is just to give you some of the sort of basic elements. Now, not all evolutionary psychologists agree with the particular details of, you know, how these modules would work or exactly what they do, so there is some debate about this, but most evolutionary psychologists say, yeah, there's at least some modularity of our brain here. All right. Introduce you to, you may have encountered this concept before, you may not have, called levels of causation. actually, it was ethologists. Ethologists were it's not like they all went extinct. Ethologists are biologists that study behavior. There are, in fact, human ethologists Human ethologists treat humans very much just as biological animals, and so they will study their behavior in sort of that setting. So you might get an ethologist that will study courtship behavior in stickleback or sparrows or humans. So, you know, this actually can be quite good. If you decide to become a human ethologist, and you can get a grant which can send you off to the bar every Friday and Saturday night so you can observe your subjects in the naturalistic setting. You know, watch males try to impress, hey baby, buy you a drink. Okay, you know, see how this works. Anyways, ethologists, in particular, Conrad Lawrence, in the 50s said, look, you got the biologists, you got the ethologists, you got the psychologists, you got the different areas of psychology, and I mean, we're often studying the same kind of thing, but everyone's arguing about who's right. And we seem to sometimes come up with totally different explanations for what's happening. So Lawrence said, look, I think the problem is, or the issue here is, that different areas of the behavioral sciences, and this could incidentally apply to any area of science, well, chemistry, physics, whatever, you name it, but they tend to approach things from different levels of causation. Okay. What does he mean? This is, okay, you may have heard like proximate versus ultimate. Now, they've got various names, but proximate developmental, phylogenetic, or ultimate, or proximate mechanistic, ontogenetic, historic, or functional. I tend to try to use the first words that are up there, but you may encounter these elsewhere using different terms. Your textbook only really talks about the proximate and the ultimate levels, but there's really four. So proximate is kind of like your cause and effect, okay? If I threw my keys at one of you and you ducked, or you pulled a Tron move and kind of grabbed them out of the air and discus threw them back at me again, right? That would, you know, there's your proximate, you know, cause, effect, all right? What's the immediate input, output with respect to a behavior? Developmental is looking at things across the lifespan. So often issues of learning. How did you acquire the ability to do that? Well, you practice grabbing things out of the air. You were in a culture that plays games where frisbees are thrown and these kinds. Okay, so picking this up. Phylogenetic. This goes back to sort of the biology of the organism. Well, we've got opposable thumbs. So, you know, we've got excellent hand-eye coordination. We've got grasping. I mean, a horse isn't going to be able to grab something out of the air like that because it's got one toe. I got it! Punk. Sorry. Okay, I mean, the best is going to use its mouth, maybe, you know. Zippy, the amazing horse that can catch frisbees. No, we don't know. Phylogenetic. Okay, so the phylogenetic is dealing with this. Could be the physiology, could be the morphology, could be the brain neurochemistry, but something about the species that, you know, allows this behavior to occur. And then the ultimate. And at the ultimate level, we're kind of down to, I mean, in particular in our context, you know, so how does this work, you know, from evolution? What's the benefit here? Why is this behavior there? Well, evolutionarily, perhaps, is more successful in the past by having the ability to do a precursor form of this behavior. Those individuals that could do a simpler form of it had a greater degree of reproductive success. They passed more of their genes on. Gradually, that was selected for until the ability spread throughout the population. Okay, so people like Lawrence were saying, you know, different groups approach this at different kinds of levels. And because not everyone works at all four of these levels, typically, I mean, like a behavioral psychologist would predominantly, I mean, an old school kind of Skinnerian behavioral psychologist would predominantly work at the proximate level. Right? I mean, discriminative stimulus, operant response, outcome. That's pretty proximate. In the presence of the green light, if you press the lever, the rat gets some rat chow. Okay. I mean, if Skinner were alive, which he's not, I mean, but if he were, he's not going to go down to the ultimate level and go, well, the ability of rats to do this kind of stimulus control would be evolutionarily adaptive for them. Okay. Developmental psychologists, you know, often more obviously at the developmental, both proximate and developmental levels. Neuropsych, you know, maybe coming in here much more at the phylogenetic. So what's the actual, you know, structure of the brain for humans? Okay, so we get different roles. Okay, so Here's what I thought we'd try here. So let's just get some people together in sort of groups. So I don't know, let's, we got like four of you there, and four of you there, and three of you there, and there's four of you back there. So, okay, so you, one, two, three, four, you guys try to work up a approximate to ultimate interpretation of food sharing between family members. I'll give you guys at the back breastfeeding, you three, monogamy, and, oh, language of sibling rivalry. Oh, let's do sibling rivalry for you guys at the back there. Okay, so take just, I don't know, 5 minutes or so, and see if you can come up, and then we'll get people to explain the rationale. See if you can think about this, how this works. Try to explain these at each of the four levels. And only has to be like a sentence or so of explanation for each. So see what you can do. All right, we're back. Okay, sibling rivalry. What'd you come up with?
Well, Bronson was kind of tough, right? Because it's a cause and effect. So I guess one thing, like, you would start fighting over who gets the food or who gets the attention. The
something.
Cause would be that.
Yeah.
And the effect would be about the rivalry.
Right, yeah. I mean, so, okay, approximate is something. You've got siblings.
Yeah.
you got at least two siblings. There's something that there's some stimulus, and then they rival about getting the outcome, whatever it is. Could be any number of things. Yep. Mm-hmm.
And then for developmental, that kind of rivalry helps them learn how to compete, and then what they then use in the real world to compete with other people.
Okay, so developmental is a learning process here that sibling rivalry allows them to learn competition. Could also be an issue here. Sometimes, and I didn't really get into this, but sometimes these things will cross a little bit. I mean, we're a species where it's not uncommon to have families with multiple siblings at once. Some species only have a sibling. So I mean, yeah, you just may, if you've got developmental, if you're around more siblings while growing up, odds are sooner or later you're going to, but yep, so learning process could be coming in. It's just part of the family life, you know, there's a, yep, uh-huh, okay.
Genetic. I don't know. I guess it's, like you said, it's the biology of the organism.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the rivalry depends on their advantages over the other biological side. So it's somebody stronger.
Sure. Yeah. Could be that. Could be. We actually raise our young. We're not sea turtles and just, you know, lay our eggs and then back into the sea and let all the turtle babies make it to the sea or not. I mean, you know, as much fun as finding Nemo was. I mean, seriously, the turtles don't move around in family groups like that. It doesn't make good Disney movie to say, and I'm Crush. I left my eggs there on the beach. Most of them got eaten by something. I'm actually a pretty stoned, bad father turtle. Matter of fact, I wouldn't actually know one of my offspring if it came up and bit me on my scaly tail. I can't do Precious ones. Or whatever his name was. Crunch? Something like that. Okay, anyways, you know the turtle I'm talking about. Right, okay, ultimate?
Yeah, I agree. Like, ultimately, they're probably fighting for the affection or care of the parents, which in return helps them grow.
Because something about that rivalry, I mean, leads to a more successful species, whatever it happens to be. There's something there that leads to greater ability to pass genes on to the next generation. Yep, okay. Monogamy.
I guess, approximately, we just talked about the limitations of our birthing system, both through, like, procreation time frame, but also the fact that there's those ultimate needs that at some point, you know, our system seems like that regular is hungry.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it can get very difficult to provide for yourself. So.
That's probably, I get that. That's probably, you're probably more getting down to a phylogenetic or developmental. Approximate might simply be something like monogamy. Well, you're married, there's not a lot of other mates around, or your culture, you're only able to secure one mate at a time, or somebody offered and you accepted, or something various, you can't afford to have more than one mate. So it could be any number of things there. Okay. So how about developmental?
There are polygamous, in one species, we can look at this group, so there's also an anomalous group.
Right. So exactly. So, I mean, in humans, it's a cultural thing. Some cultures allow for polygamy, others do not. So that's going to be some sort of a cultural-based system there, probably. Yep. You do what you learned. Yep. Follow genetic.
Biologically programmed in each of them, so that people are looking for love, they're looking for that person to spend the rest of their life. It's almost like that's biological.
Okay, so we've got something about our physiology, blending of neurotransmitters, the whatnot that allows us to adopt this. Okay. Okay. Yep. And ultimate?
Well, you can only have so many kids, right?
True.
The reverse spacing effect says that if you have an age, if you have someone who doesn't have the children, you can have more children.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Because you don't have to keep caring for that child. Just
right. So in something like humans, our offspring are very expensive to raise. You may not be able to do it by yourself. Those individuals that engage in a monogamous structure have more of their young survive. So over time, this became a selected force system. Okay, good. Nueva, you're doing, I can't remember what you're doing. What are you doing?
Food sharing.
Oh, food sharing. Right, food sharing, yeah. What you got? Okay. So if you're living in a group and there's cross generations there, you're just exposed to food sharing. Okay.
And then phylogenetic, we had our digestive systems can only let us process certain foods.
Okay. Okay. Well, for phylogenetic, it could be something like, well, we live in groups, and so at least the opportunity for food sharing exists. I mean, if you were a fairly individually living, only came together particularly for mating, then you probably wouldn't bother food sharing. But because we do live in groups, large social groups, then odds are that we're at least going to encounter others. Be around others, and so those opportunities for food sharing are going to exist. Yep. Okay.
And then for ultimate, we said that we want our family members to eat so that we can all survive and survive together, so we want to help them be able to eat.
Okay. Why do we want all of our family members to survive?
Because share your genetics.
Ah, there we go. Yes, so if more of your family members actually manage to survive, more of your genes that you share in common with them are out there and being passed on. Right. Good. Okay. And breastfeeding? Breastfeeding. Right. What you got?
Okay, well, we weren't really sure about the distinction between proximate and developmental because the baby cries and he gets fed.
Right.
Or it could be the mom puts the baby to her breast and feeds, and so he could learn that that's how you get fed. And so if I cry, then she puts me there. So that could be more developmental.
Right. Could you could you see there can be some cross between these as you're all discovering. These are not actually specifically they're sort of soft margined group distinctions where they will bleed together. But in terms of a stimulus for the breastfeeding, it could be baby cries. This really and mom feeds baby, or baby's hungry, mom feeds baby, or baby suckles, and this causes the milk letdown response. Could be any number of things, but something that's fairly immediate in terms of this happens, and then the actual breastfeeding behavior occurs there. Okay, how about developmental? You're sort of bleeding between the sort
that's
of
where we also have, maybe the baby learns the best way to get fed is to cry or to make a certain face
okay.
or a certain do something specific, so they sort of learn what is the best way to get the mother to meet them.
Okay. Yeah, that could certainly, from if you look at it from the baby's perspective, it's like what's happening in terms of learning here. If you look at it from another, and that's fine. We can look at it from another way as well. Do all cultures breastfeed to the same extent? Anyone know what sort of the incidence of breastfeeding is in, say, North America? Compared to, say, Zimbabwe or something else? Stunningly low is the answer, right? Despite all of the science that indicates that breastfeeding for the first 2 years, it's not continuous breastfeeding, but breastfeeding for at least 2 years, if not up to four, leads to massive advantages in infants with respect to immune system, cognitive development, all kinds of things. But the formula is readily available in North America, and in fact, for many, many, many years, the medical, pharmaceutical, and formula-producing groups pushed the advantages and benefits of formula feeding. So, in fact, breastfeeding is actually relatively low in our culture. It's higher in Canada than it is in the United States, but not by a lot. There's differences in Canada in terms of the amount of time women can have off from their jobs for pregnancy. In Canada, it's almost a year. It's basically about almost 11 months time off. They get essentially a form of EI during that period, and their job has to be kept for them. If their job has to be filled, they have to be offered a comparable or better job at the same place that they left before going on mat leave. In the United States, it varies a bit, but it's basically about 10 weeks. After that, your job may not be there for you. So it's pretty tough to have to go back to your job after 10 weeks if you want that job back and try to get back to nurse, you know, 10 or 12 weeks, hard to get back to nurse your infant, who at that point, you know, needs to be nursing pretty much every hour, hour and a half, 2 hours. So formula comes in. So we get different cultural effects there. So, yeah, those could come in. So you're right. You could look at it from the point of view of the baby. You could look at it from the point of view of the culture. You could look at it, yeah, various ways to do this. Yep, okay. Phylogenetic. Okay, yep, you can definitely look at it that way. So, I mean, we have the underlying those neural connectors that do this. So we're also just mammals. If you're a reptile, you couldn't breastfeed even if you wanted to. So I scale-fed my young from eggs. No. So, yep, but you're right. So, okay, and then ultimate?
Survival. I guess more so, like, not now, just because there is formula that's so readily available, but it used to be for survival.
It was the way it was. Yeah, that's how it worked. Okay, good. What you're probably noticing is for some of these ultimates, they may not, you may have to go back a little bit. You know, again, they bleed into the phylogenetic, and they may go back to a precursor species of humans. And so you're going to say, well, okay, so I mean, early mammals that started the lactation process, what bennies did that give them over reptiles or monotremes, you know? I mean, now we've only got the wacky platypus and the echidnas, two species of echidnas as monotremes. But there used to be a lot more, as the egg-laying mammals. So what advantages did marsupials, which do lactate for the young, and then finally full placental mammals, what advantages did that have? So you may, in some of these cases, may have to pop back a bit in time to look at that. You know, don't have to leave the young for periods. Young are with you. You have constant nutrition for them. It's not dependent upon finding food and having it transported back. The mom is the transport system for the food. These sorts of things. Yeah.
Would that involve like the developmental, like the role and like how we learn through all the mirror neurons? I mean, all that. Behavior?
Sure. You could bring mirror neurons into that as well. If you observe mom breastfeed your younger siblings, then you may be more likely to do that than if you didn't. For example, in a non-human species, orangutans. Orangutans are a very asocial primate, great ape. They're like the pretty much least social of the great apes. Males don't really hang around the females. They stay off in their own little area. They only really get together, the females, to mate. Females will, if they have a son, their son will stay with mom for about 4 years, and then bip, 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 off he goes. She will then mate, have the next offspring. If she has a daughter, her daughter stays with her for 8 years. So through her first sort of 4 years of child to young adult, and then sticks around for another four and observes and helps a bit with mom's second pregnancy. So daughters get taught, right? They get to watch mom do all this. And so you're right, the observational learning thing is big. There's been some very interesting stuff done with cross-species observational learning this. In fact, there was a, I've forgotten which zoo, my wife would know this. I guess I could phone her right now. Well, it doesn't matter. But a particular zoo in the States that had a gorilla, a female gorilla, gave birth, but she was having problems nursing. Again, captive raised and whatnot, and so hadn't been around, you know, grown up with her mother, having other young to observe this yourself. And so what the zoo did was they actually had human nursing mothers come in and sit in front of, sit in close proximity to the gorilla and show her nursing the human child. And upon observing that, the gorilla mom was able to pick this up and was successful at nursing her own baby. So, yeah, the observational learning comes in with these things very, very significant. So, yeah, okay. So, anyways, I know, hopefully you found that kind of an interesting, useful thing. But we get this in all kinds of areas of psychology. So, I mean, you'll get different psychologists in different areas kind of sometimes arguing about, no, this is the right way to... This is the right way to look at it. No, you're looking at it wrong. Oh, no, you can't just limit yourself by looking at the cause and effect, the stimulus control. No, you've got to understand the developmental background. And somebody's like, well, the developmental background of rats is pretty unimportant, says the behaviorist. Oh, but for humans, you're using rats as a model for... Oh. And then the knives come out, and it's wee, wee, wee. And you go from there. Actually, it's not all that... We don't tend to actually get psychologists being that kind of... exciting with their, they just write like nasty letters back and forth at one another in respectable journals. Okay, so different areas of science are going to operate at these different levels. Different areas of psychology are going to operate at different levels of causation. And consequently, you may get radically different interpretations, even within the same level, depending, like we got infant versus sort of societal approach to things. You may get very different kinds of interpretations. In terms of monogamy, there again, you may be looking at across cultures. Different cultures may practice a form of monogamy for different reasons as well. So there can be a lot of different things occurring there. Now, depending on, and as I said, evolutionary psychology is this big sort of theory umbrella that can be applied to all these different subdisciplines to a greater or lesser extent. And so consequently, depending on which discipline the evolutionary psych is being brought into, what particular target behavior is being considered, you may get it operating at all of these different levels. I mean, evolutionary psychologists may even be operating at the different... although they tend to... You know, I mean, that's what your textbook is. Your textbook only talks about the proximate and the ultimate. It kind of lumps the proximate and developmental and the phylogenetic and the ultimate together. I don't really like that approach to doing things, but then I'm kind of my background is kind of hardcore biology, so I kind of see a bit more advantage to separating these out a bit. But you can certainly get evolutionary psychologists operating at these different levels, depending on what they're sort of focusing. You don't find a lot of just like pure evolutionary psychology. You find a few that are just theorizers, but they're really more just like evolutionary biologists, really. The vast majority of people that do evolutionary psychology are doing it in the context of a specific research field. So whichever, you know, say developmental or linguistic or whatnot, that is going to slot them into a particular one or two levels of causation more predominantly than others. Okay, there's that. So I haven't really told you my background. I started in zoology, and then for a variety of rather interesting reasons, including the non-employability of people with honors zoology degrees, I ended up getting a master's in history, and then I ended up doing my PhD in psychology. I am, as it turns out, one of the world authorities on spatial representation during the hunting behavior of water striders. Yeah, that's the response that a lot of people have. It's like, seriously? It's like, uh-huh. It's like, so do you still do anything with them? It's like, hell no. That was like way too many years of my life watching bugs eat other bugs. It's like, no. Did you publish everything for your thesis? Like, no, I had reams and reams more data that I could have analyzed, but I would have had to go probably completely, you know, insane to do that. So I eventually just threw all of those tapes out. Anywho, but I do have this background in history. So I will not be asking you on any exam to remember particular dates or names or things like that. But given issues with evolutionary theory and issues with how evolution becomes addressed in general public discussion, almost everybody has something to say about evolution, right? I mean, nobody argues about the teaching of subatomic physics in school, right? But people argue about the teaching of evolution or aspects. Okay, so everybody thinks they have something to say about evolution. So I'm going to historically contextualize things a little bit for you. Listen, I'm not going to be testing you on specifics here with this, but it becomes a little bit important to understand some of the framework of where modern evolutionary psych is within our within both the social aspect of science, so within the culture of science and within the culture of, well, the non-scientists, non-academics, because it's kind of significant in this. So here's a bit of a background on this here. So here's the first thing. Some people think that evolution theory basically starts with Darwin. Darwin heads off on the beagle, goes around the world for 5 years, comes back, goes, hey, I just had this idea. I think things evolve. Crazy, huh? What do you think with that? He's like, oh, that's amazing. I never thought of it. No, I mean, this didn't start with Darwin. Greeks. I mean, it probably goes back before the Greeks, but I mean, you know, the Greeks were some of the first people that actually bothered to write stuff down. I mean, the Egyptians did write stuff down, but they were mostly concerned with things like, we kicked ass in Sumeria, woo-hoo, you know, that kind of stuff. So they were a little different. But anyways, evolutionary theories, and there were theories well before Charles Darwin's theory of evolution. All evolutionary theories basically address two things. First, how do organisms change with time? And second, how do new organisms develop? Now, this probably, with respect to the first one, as soon as you have got any sort of consistent agrarian structure where people are trying to produce particular forms of food, not just like randomly finding food that's wrong, but actually improve it. Like, for example, something's coming on, anyone gonna like get into the whole corn cob thing, you know, corn on the cob, or, you know what corn started as? Little things about this big that were toxic. Okay? So you had to cook it first off, or it was just probably going to either make you really sick, and if you eat enough, it would just kill you, kind of like acorns. Okay? And so over a period of about 6,000 years, people that were living in Central and South America started breeding it up from these little things. You know, you get like the Asian dishes, little baby corns? Yeah, it's sort of what it started with, except, you know, you really wouldn't have been good for you to eat a whole bunch of them. So they started very slowly to breed these things up until you got longer these big ears of corn. It took a while. Okay? So as soon as you start doing that, though, you got to have some meta representation. Of course, we talked about that. Ability to conceptualize. You know, I think this corn is changing. I remember my great-grandfather talking about how he ate a whole bunch of the little corns and got violently sick and thought he was going to die. And that doesn't seem to happen. You know, don't get as sick. And they seem bigger, you know. I remember when I was young, the corn was only the size of my finger. And it's like, Grandpa, you lost that finger. A caiman bit it off. Well, whatever. Okay, you get the idea. right? If you are doing agriculture, if you are selectively breeding things, right? You know that organisms change across generations. Okay? So anyone that's doing any sort of agrarian structure knows, goes back even earlier than this. You know how long dogs have been domesticated for? Well, no, nobody does really. But probably at least 14 to 18,000 years. How do we know? Well, if you go actually up and find dog skulls, some dog skulls have been carbon dated, and other forms of dating as well from the north, where they had some of these go back at least some of the skulls. And they look remarkably like wolf skulls, incidentally, but go back about at least 14,000 years. And how do we know these were domesticated? Well, some of these dogs have got little square divots in their skulls. A little square divot is a type of rivet that holds an Inuit dog sled whip handle together. Okay? If you find modern dog sled teams, if you do an autopsy on them after the dog eventually dies, it is not uncommon to find these little square divots in their skulls. Dogs on dog sled teams are not really all that. They're talking about sibling rivalry. Well, they're just rivalry, okay? And so the human, who doesn't want his dogs tearing each other apart, will sometimes have to wade into things and start smacking them on the head to get them to break up the fight. Very often uses whatever's at hand, which happens to be the handle of the whip. So you go bang on the top. Some of these, the rivet leaves a little indentation, stuns the dog. Oh, okay. Doesn't kill the dog. It's not usual. Okay. I mean, you know, these skulls I'm talking about, you know, bone regrew. Leaves a divot there. So that's going back at least 14,000 years. Well, I mean, you know, that's not natural. It's not like, oh, a walrus jumped out of the water and bit the dog on the head and caused a square little. It's like, no. That's got to come from something human made. Okay, so that suggests that we've at least 14,000. Well, as soon as you start trying to domesticate dogs, right, and most human populations have tried to domesticate some form of doggy sort over the years, again, you get the idea that over generations, you're changing them. Okay, so things change across generations. You get into the Greeks, though, and this is where we've got some of the first sort of relevant writings about this. So Thales and Empedocles talked about change occurring in different species across time. Conscious, but I mean, not everyone agreed, right? Aristotle, for example, of whom we've got a lot of writings from, and this is an interesting, I mean, people say, oh, Aristotle, that's great ideas. Aristotle just got lucky enough that his stuff was preserved for whatever reason. I mean, he may not have been the most popular thinker of the time. He just might have paid to have the most copies of his scrolls translated out, you know, bestsellers. Right? I mean, think about this. You know, come back 2,000 years from now, what's going to remain? Some brilliant articles in say, psychology or, you know, the Da Vinci Code. Oh, the Da Vinci Code, the height of the late 20th, early 21st century reasoning about... Anyways, so, you know, but Aristotle took the view that there was a strict and very rigid hierarchy. So, in fact, he was actually arguing sort of against an evolutionary process. You know, things fit within a particular ladder structure, if you will. Let's skip forward a long bit of time. As I said, I'm not going to give you all the history of this, but I just want to point out that the classical period, people were at least talking about evolutionary issues. They were thinking about it. They didn't know the mechanism, but they knew that things changed. They knew that new stuff occurred. They were kind of vague on exactly how that happened in many cases. But again, I mean, the Greeks bred all kinds of goats and stuff. I mean, they knew how to get bigger goats, and they knew how to produce different types of plants, food crops, and whatnot. So, I mean, again, there was the idea of evolution. Skip into the 16th century here with Francis Bacon. Published a book in 1620 called Novum Organum. And in this, Bacon's specifically talking about the variation that occurs across generations. If you look at different generations of animals, you will see that they will change with time. So again, we're seeing here a very, very specific, I mean, it's not talking about the mechanisms of evolution, but he's giving data that says, yes, this happens. Things will change. If you breed chickens or pigeons or cows or dogs, they will change with time. You will get different effects over time there. Gottfried Leibniz, a fascinating guy, general all-around scientist there, but got interested for a period in geological things, including fossils, so ammonites and nautilus fossils. Now, one of the things that's happening in the 17th and 18th centuries, particularly in the 17th century, is there starts to be a real push to make buildings out of limestone. For whatever reason, it becomes fat. Okay? How do you get limestone? Well, you get limestone by making big quarries. What's limestone? Well, limestone comes from the fossilized remnants of all kinds of little ocean critters. And so to get limestone, you'd have these huge open pit quarries. People just go down and cut off the side of a mountain, essentially. Okay? And because of this, and then go down to the ground as well. Because of this, people like Leibniz could actually walk down the scaffolding, and as they're walking down, they're going back in time. And you look at the fossils that are being found at different levels, and Leibniz says, hey, look, you know, there's a whole bunch of this particular type of ammonite right here, and then it's gone. And if we go down below that, there's something that looks a little more primitive, and then, I mean, it vanishes, this new thing comes. So by doing this through, I mean, the architecture that's going on, Leibniz gets this incredible insight into fossils. That things seem to exist for some period of time, and then they change. New species replace old. And he argues that this is due to environmental factors. Something in the environment changed. He doesn't know what, but something changed, and perhaps this organism wasn't as good at surviving anymore. Okay. Georges Leclerc, sometimes called the Comte de Buffon. Now, what's happening in the 18th century with respect to Europeans is they're hopping in boats, sailing all over the world, discovering new species of animals, generally then shooting them and stuffing them in jars of alcohol, or drawing pictures of them and bringing them back, or skinning them and bringing their hides back. So in the 18th century, we get all kinds of animals, either pictures or skins or bones or sometimes live animals, being brought back into Europe. So, for example, the North American bison used to have a much broader range than it has now, obviously. But samples of North American bison, both pictures and hides, were being brought back into Europe. So Leclerc looks at this and says, well, you know, the bison, I mean, it seems sort of like, you know, a European ox, but it's furrier. It's much, much furrier than Northern European ox. Now, in this time period, there's a mini ice age going on, so actually, North America was actually pretty cold. And so, I mean, people that would come over to North America would say, oh, it's, you know, it's beautiful, there's lots of trees, there's space, but damn, it's cold, okay? You know, very short growing seasons. And so, well, you know, now, they didn't have any sense that this was a mini ice age that was going on for about 400 years or so. But Leclerc says, well, it's colder in North America, and the bison is furrier than the European ox. So I think what's happened here is this bison animal has adapted to its environment. It's grown a furrier coat. If we look at things like Icelandic ponies versus Arabian horses, right? Shaggier coats makes sense. If it's cold, you're going to still, you know, it's pony versus horse, but you know, you're going to have these adaptations to the environment. So he starts bringing these in. Immanuel Kant, if you take in philosophy, you will almost certainly encounter Kant. But Kant says, you know, a very interesting little footnote to this, not most of what Kant wrote about, he said, you know, he got thinking about, as well, apes were being brought in, things like chimpanzees and other monkeys and, you know, non-apes, primates were being brought back into Europe from Africa, tropical regions and whatnot. And, you know, so he encountered some of these in zoos and whatnot. He said, you know, it's possible that over time, with the right situations, it's not unreasonable to suspect that apes, and he's talking about things like chimpanzees and orangutans, it's possible to envision sometime in the future where they could actually develop the cognitive reasoning skills of humans. So a very interesting sort of view. He made this connection between the cognitive abilities of our ape relatives, and when we recognize that they were relatives of us biologically speaking at this point, but made the connection and said, you know, if just enough time passes, perhaps they too could gain the thinking abilities of humans, the reasoning abilities. Okay. Skip forward here to this guy, Erasmus Darwin. Actually, Charles Darwin's grandfather. picture or a carving of a mirror from his house in the West Countries, West Counties of England. Was there a few years ago. Darwin was an interesting guy, Erasmus Darwin. He was a medical doctor. By today's standards, we'd probably describe him as like a celebrity doctor, because, I mean, he was the doctor for very, very rich people. He was once requested, I mean, King George III of England asked Erasmus to become his personal physician, and he turned him down. But, I mean, you know, to be the king's personal physician, give you an idea, I mean, Darwin was pretty rich. I mean, he was probably making, in today's terminology, several million dollars a year. So he did all right for himself. He was also, like, obesely fat. I mean, grossly fat. I mean, just huge. I mean, you get the sense from the picture there. Jowls, all of this. But smart, fascinating. He was also, like, a poet. He was essentially England's poet laureate for a few years there. I mean, so, you know, not particularly, I guess, physically attractive, but, married very well. Married very well to younger women. His first wife was actually quite ill through much of her life. She credited Darwin's medical skills with keeping her alive as long as she did live. He had several children by her. He then had brought a nanny in to look after the kids after he died. Had a relationship with the nanny, producing several children with the nanny, a few daughters. Then remarried to the daughter of Wedgwood. So if you know anything about your Wedgwood pottery, married the daughter of that family. And to give you an idea, the girl he married was her family was very, very rich. She was being courted by most of the eligible bachelors in England. And she picked Erasmus. She didn't have to. I mean, her family would have backed her on whoever she picked, but Wedgwood and Darwin, their families knew each other, all these things. But she picked Darwin. So, I mean, despite being older than she was and really not physically attractive, he was smart, he was intelligent, and he valued intelligence in women. So he took his daughters from his nanny and he set them up as teachers. So he set them up as teachers, and he wrote the curriculum for their school. It was a school for girls, but he wrote the curriculum for them, and he wrote it exactly as he would write curriculum for his sons. So he had the feeling that women should be able to be taught in exactly the same way as men. So a very, very fascinating guy. Inventor. He invented, amongst other things, one of the things that's relevant to us now is the front differential steering on cars. Back before this, carriages, the front axle was just solid, and so it would pivot around a central point. What this means is when going around a corner, the wheels are going to be trying to spin at different speeds. They can't. You take a corner too quickly, the carriage is going to flip. A lot of people got killed in carriage crashes. Darwin was too big to ride a horse, so he'd go out on his medical appointments in a carriage, and he recognized this was dangerous. And so he said, well, what if we just cut the axle in half, thereby allowing each wheel to rotate freely on its own, and each axle to independently set? And that's essentially how our modern cars are designed as well. So, develop that. Okay, anyways, he gets interested in biology as well. He writes up his thoughts on this in a poem, an epic poem called Botanic Garden. So he's publishing his science in poetic verse. We just don't see enough of this anymore, unfortunately. But he comes up with some interesting things. He suggests that there's a single common origin for the beginning of life. Things came from a very simple original form, and then complexity came in. And Darwin, Erasmus Darwin, argued that competition is the driving principle behind evolution. Competition for access to resources, be they food, be they mates, that this is what drives evolution. This is why some things outcompete others. Charles Darwin's grandfather, right? So, I mean, Chuck, you know, as I sometimes call him, is exposed to concepts of evolution within his own household. Okay. Around the same time, we've got Baron George Cuvier. Cuvier suggests that, and this one still comes down to us now, the details are a little different, catastrophism. So he says, you know, what seems to lead to, his suggestion was, what leads to these, you know, sudden changes, or apparently sudden changes in the fossil records, is that some huge catastrophe occurs, wipes out most of the things living during the time, and the new stuff, you know, because it's not dealing with any competition, the competition's been wiped out, new things that are left repopulate, and we get another explosion of new life forms. Now, Cuvier thought that what was causing these wipeouts of life were massive volcanic eruptions that would periodically just occur across the face of the Earth. Nowadays, the general idea is we get smacked with an asteroid every now and then that does pretty much the same job. So Cuvier's idea, with a little bit, you know, with a twist, has really come down to us still. It's the predominant view for what has led to some of the mass extinctions that have occurred periodically in the history of our planet. Incidentally, we are due for another massive extinction. We should be smacked by an asteroid, just probabilistically, more or less any time now, give or take about 10 million years. We'll see what happens in 2012, shall we? Anyhow, this guy, Jean-Baptiste Lamarck, French natural historian, we'd say today, French biologist, brilliant guy. Unfortunately, very, very unfairly, tends to get mocked in high school textbooks as getting evolution totally fracking raw. It's like, what a stupid guy. He thought that characteristics that you acquired during your lifespan, we passed on. Yeah, it's called, actually that might happen. As it turns out, Lamarck is slightly getting vindicated in rather a different way than he thought. But it wasn't a stupid idea. Given what he had to work with, Lamarck's idea here is that evolution occurs because organisms will experience things during life, and those experiences will actually be inherited. I'm not sure what's been going on with the with the podcast there. I'll listen to it later and see whether or not I've just missed the last half hour or stuff. Right, acquired during life. So his idea was that these would be inherited by the offspring. So if you go to the gym and work out and build up muscle mass, your offspring will be more muscular. If you take this, take a psychology degree, your children will inherit your psychological knowledge and be more psychology-ish. You get the idea. Okay, so now, it doesn't work quite like that. There are some interesting things going on with possibly down at the level of the genes that may influence what's inherited based on experience, but that's kind of a different level here. So this is his idea. Now, what's important with this is while the particulars of inherited characteristics being passed or acquired characteristics being inherited is generally wrong, Lamarck's very significant because he was the first one to really give a specific mechanism by which evolutionary change could occur. Nobody else had really done this. Not even Erasmus had really come up with this. Now, he did feel there was a movement towards higher forms, and this sometimes gets linked back to Aristotle's view of this hierarchy of forms, but it's not quite the same thing. I mean, what Erasmus was really saying is, if you look back at the fossil record, you know, you go back in time, things were pretty simple. You know, ooh, I got a snail. Ooh, you know, that was sort of it. But if you follow us along, things become more complicated. So that's what he's really meaning in terms of moving towards higher forms. He didn't specifically say it's got to be moving towards us. But he said, we're obviously a lot more complicated than worms, so something going on there. Okay, so that was Lamarck. So this is the environment, if you will, in which the academic environment, the thought environment, in which Charles Darwin is existing. Now, Charles was kind of an interesting guy. His grandfather, famous doctor. His father, a very successful surgeon. The expectation was that the Darwin boys would go on in their father and grandfather's footsteps and become medical doctors. And his older brother did in fact go off to Edinburgh to train as a surgeon. And Charles was sent off to Edinburgh to learn surgery as well. Slight problem. It turns out that he would feel nauseous and sometimes pass out at the sight of blood, which is very difficult if you're going to be a surgeon. right? Because, I mean, you're good for the first sort of like, you know, incision, and then you fall over and somebody else has to step in and finish your surgery. You don't get paid very much for doing that. But Charles had issues with confronting authority. He was not a particularly forceful kind of guy. And so he couldn't really explain to his father that he didn't really want to be a surgeon. And so he did what seemed to be the only sensible thing, which was simply to not tell him. And things went on like this for a while, or he's up in Edinburgh with his brother and, you know, really not going to classes and certainly not doing the surgical dissections, but having a rather good time in Edinburgh all the same, in pubs and hanging out with, you know, certain possible women of questionable morality and all these sorts of things. And everything's going great until Dad shows up and goes, "Oh, I'm going to sit in on one of your surgical procedures." It's like, yeah, about that. Dad was not particularly happy, especially since he'd been paying for all this for the last few years. So it's like, all right, fine. My older son doesn't pass out at the sight of blood. No, good, all right. Well, at least we got one. Mm-hmm. Parson. Being a parson would be an acceptable choice for a second son. Country parson. So, you know, Darwin thinks about this. He goes, oh, all right, that's right. You know, you work Sunday morning, the rest of the week's more or less off. You know, and what Darwin really liked was stuff like geology and entomology and botany. And so, very interesting with the English university system. So you could be registered in a program. So in fact, he comes down from Sutherland, and he's registered as in theology. But you don't actually, unlike here. So I mean, you know, here you're registered in psychology. You have to take so many, you know, course units of psychology, yada yada yada, all of that particular requirements, this sort of thing. That didn't really exist in the university system. I mean, if you were registered in theology, you could pretty much take whatever courses you wanted. At the end of, you know, 4 years, you would have to write some just terrible exams. Your theology instructors, who may never have actually gone to one of the classes, would decide what you should know. And you would write literally like a week's worth of exams, morning and afternoon, so like series of 4 hour long exams over the course of a week. And they could ask you anything. I mean, anything that they thought you should have been able to figure out over 4 years. Now, if you never took a theology course, but you still somehow figured this stuff out, great. Okay. Consequently, I mean, for example, law as well. You never actually really had to go to a law class. If you could pass the bar, if you could pass your exams, you'd be a lawyer. You don't actually have to. I think in England this is still the case. You don't actually have to really take any classes. If you somehow have acquired all the knowledge to do well enough to do this, you can practice law. Okay. A little different from America. So Darwin doesn't actually really bother you. He doesn't really like theology courses. He'd rather just take these courses in the biological and geological sciences. And that's what he does. And so it's coming up to time, and he's supposed to be taking his monster exam. And he pretty much recognizes that he's going to fail. And he pretty much recognizes his dad's going to be really pissed off at him again. So he gets this incredible opportunity. There's a voyage of scientific exploration, the Beagle, that is about to set off. And the captain wants to have someone on board the ship that he can actually have an intelligent conversation with over dinner every night. And so the captain, a guy called Fitzwilliams, I believe it was, asks the Don of Botany at Oxford if he'd like to come along on the trip. Now, the Don of Botany at Oxford goes, "Oh, gee, thanks very much, but, you know, 5 years on a very small ship with a bunch of smelly sailors, good pass on that, because, hey, I'm the Don of Botany at Oxford. Life is pretty sweet here. But I have this student, a guy called Charles. He'd be great." Now, Charles thinks it's brilliant because, you know, he figures, you know, 5 years on a boat, Dad's going to get out, he's going to be pretty happy to see him when he gets back, and if he's really lucky, something might just kill him on the voyage, and he'll have to avoid telling his father that he's not really going to be a country parson after all. So Darwin heads off on this voyage for 5 years. That's how he ends up in the Beagle. It wasn't any sort of planned thing. It was like a good chance to avoid dealing with an unpleasant social situation. And, you know, as we all know the sort of story about this, in the Galapagos Islands, Darwin encounters an alien artifact. Once he touches it, unlocks certain ideas of evolution. He then throws a bone up in space, and it turns into a... Sorry, that's 2001. different, no. So Darwin goes on this voyage, sees lots of different animals all over the place. The big breakthrough comes at the Galapagos, where there's a wide range of environmental situations in very close proximity and between different islands. And so it's the winter. We've got very similar animals, but you know, we've got a tree-based and arboreal iguana. We've got a ground-dwelling iguana. And we've got a marine iguana. They're all, I mean, clearly iguanas. How do we get this kind of variation, this kind of diversity? So he starts thinking about this. Now, he'd also taken along to read with him Malthus's Essays on the Principle of Population. Now, this is really a political economics text. And Malthus is arguing that there's a finite amount of monetary resources in any country. Not everyone is going to be rich, which means if you don't have enough money, you're just going to starve to death and die. So Malthus is saying not everyone is going to survive. Darwin extrapolates this into biology. He says, that's it. Not all organisms survive long enough to be able to reproduce. And even those that do reproduce, not all are going to be equally successful. Their young may not survive. So this is it. This is how we get the change. Those that are better adapted, those that have some characteristics that make them better at surviving in an environment, they are the ones that will have more offspring. Those offspring then will go on to populate that particular environment. If environments change, then new characteristics may be better adapted. Incidentally, besides taking Malthus, he also took the complete works of Jane Austen with him. He said, I cannot imagine going 5 years without reading the works of Jane Austen. So, now, gets back, 1836. By 1837, he started a notebook called On the Transformation of Species. And within 6 months, he's basically done. 6 months, he's got basically his whole theory of evolution. Takes him until 1859 to get around to publishing this called On the Origin of Species. Now, there's various reasons for this, but Darwin's wife, very religious, and Darwin had a pretty good sense that if he was talking about barnacles, no one was going to care too much, but as soon as he starts talking about people, and his wife gave him enough of a view on this, that there was going to be trouble. So Darwin kept saying, well, I just need to collect a little bit more data. I just need to make my argument a little bit stronger. I just need to do this research. And so he kept doing it, kept putting it off. Anyone read On the Origin of Species? No? It's a read, you know? No, it's actually not bad. It's nicely written. He starts by talking, he says, okay, look, we're running out of time. He says, basically, there's three things that are important here for evolution work. Variation, inheritance, and selection. That is, I don't have any identical twins in the class here, but if you look around, everybody's a little bit different. Everybody, there's variation. Okay, so that's the variation. The inheritance. And again, he didn't understand the genetic mechanisms of this. He was actually completely wrong on it. He thought inheritance was a blended structure. But he says somehow offspring have at least some of the characteristics of their parents. Certain things are inherited. Okay? If those attributes that are inherited confer an advantage on those offspring, they will be selected for. If those offspring's characteristics confer a disadvantage, they will be selected against. Those that have the adaptations will probably produce more offspring. Okay. So this, again, like Lamarck, he's got a causal mechanism. Unlike Lamarck, his seems more or less to actually work. He talks about three types of selection. That's what artificial selection, natural, and sexual selection. Now, he talks about artificial selection just to sort of lead his book in. Everyone in England understood basically agrarian practices, so he talks about things like, in the first few chapters, things like breeding pigeons and or cows or different forms of plants and animals and whatnot. That's artificial. The farmer selects the characteristics that he wants to be passed on. He says, in nature, it's the same thing, except there's no farmer doing it. The farmer is the environment. He also talks a little bit about sexual selection, only a little bit in On the Origins of Species. He really comes back to sexual selection in a later book. So we'll talk about that later. But an important final point to make here is Darwin is very clear. He says evolution is not intentional. There is no end goal. It is not Aristotle's hierarchical pattern of development leading to humans. We are not the end point here. We are not the pinnacle. Okay. So it's gradual, In other words, it's going to be very slow. It's based upon generations. And finally says, the important thing is not just the number of offspring that are had, but what he calls the differential reproductive success. That is, if you have 20 offspring, you go, woohoo, but they all get eaten. Or, you know, a tree falls on them. You suck from an evolutionary perspective. Okay, he says, you've got a different, that has one offspring, but that offspring survives to have one offspring. Differential reproductive success for that one is a lot higher than the other one that had 20 offspring, but they all die. So differential reproductive success is what's important. Okay, we will stop there for the day because I think this is when I'm supposed to stop. And